360's The Week That Was, the most listened to hour in Territory Radio. The Territory leaders break down this week's big issues.
Now proudly brought to you by De Silva Hebron, and joining us in the studio for The Week That Was, we have got the opposition leader, Leah Finocchiaro. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
We have got Robin Lamley, the independent member for Araluen. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie.
We have got Natasha Files, who is the Minister for Health and Tourism. Good morning.
Morning, Wolfie.
And we've got Matt Cunningham from Sky News.
G'day, Katie.
Good to have you all in the studio. And I tell you what, I've been a bit crook the last couple of days, but the first day I couldn't get out of bed. The second day, which was yesterday, I spent the day watching Parliament. And that's probably
Katie,
the time
what?
I'm not going to get back.
That would have put you to sleep.
Improve your health or make it worse?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you. But I tell you what, it has been a massive week around the Territory, particularly when you talk about crime. Now, both the ALP and the CLP presented their solutions for the issues that we have when it comes to crime in the Territory. Some questioning if it goes far enough, others questioning why the government stepped away from the Royal Commission. However you look at it, laws to crack down on youth crime won't be in force in the Territory now until later this year, after the opposition's push to change those bail rules on urgency was shot down by the government. The NT News reporting that the government's proposed package of reforms, which include throwing kids into remand if they breach bail and expanding the use of electronic monitoring devices, will not be introduced in Parliament, as I said, until May, and may not actually be debated until June or August. The NT News also understands that laws that will allow police to test child drivers for alcohol and drugs without a responsible adult around won't be introduced in Parliament until August. Now, opposition leader Leah Finocchiaro, you have slammed the government's decision to knock back that debate of your bail amendment bill on urgency as pathetic and gutless.
Because it is, Katie. This was a really disgusting week for the Gunner government. I mean, we have been for months preparing legislation. It's very simple, six-page reform. It's designed to be the first stage in putting the balance back into victims' rights over offenders' rights. Our reform is very simple. We wanted people who are repeat offenders to start with a position of no bail. We want to bring back breach of bail condition as an offence. And if you are still bailed, despite the fact that we would put those repeat offenders in a position of no bail, if the court still decided to bail someone, we're saying they should be mandatorily electronically monitored. And all three of those reforms we want to apply to adults and to youth. The Gunner government came out this week with a very random package of reform that we won't see happen until right through to the end of the year. And we said, well, if you're really serious about cracking down on crime and dealing with this issue and putting, you know, the rights of victims above the rights of offenders, back our bill. Let's get that first stage moving and then we'll work together and look at your stuff when it gets to May. But they just shot it down. You know, every victim that is perpetrated on by a repeat offender or someone out on bail from Wednesday onwards, it sits squarely at the feet of the Gunner government because they had the chance to legislate and do something about it.
Robin, my understanding is that you supported the CLP's push in Parliament this week. Obviously, the government didn't. Is that the case?
Well, all that happened really was a motion was put to have it debated on urgency. So the actual legislation wasn't debated at all, Katie. Yep. What happened in Parliament this week was a lot of words and no action. And from my perspective, from as a MP from Alice Springs, that's just not good enough. There was an opportunity provided by the opposition to put in place amendments to the Bail Act. Mm-hmm. The government could have come in and changed the proposed amendments by the opposition 100%, but they chose to walk away from that, and that's just not good enough. People around the Territory are suffering, and to hear that we're probably going to have to wait until the end of the year for any change of the legislation is really quite appalling.
The thing that I couldn't quite wrap my head around, and I did ask the police minister a few times about it, was whether this presumption against against bail was actually going to change or not. And to be honest, I'm still not 100% sure what the go is.
It's not going to. So we asked the Chief Minister twice in question time this week because he's talking a big game saying if you're a serious offender and you breach a bail, you'll be remanded. And then they're talking about... So this government in 2019 created two categories of offences for use, prescribed and non-prescribed. Prescribed, people who commit a prescribed offence have a neutral presumption of bail. So they rock up to court and there's no presumption one way or the other. Your bail is just dealt with. If you commit a non-prescribed offence, then you have a presumption in favour of bail. Now, there are crimes on the non-prescribed list, like hit and run, abduction, dangerous driving causing death. So it's inadequate. This government are now saying, well, under our new reform, we're going to move some of those crimes in the non-prescribed list to the prescribed list.
And so do you mean for like first offenders or people who have who've done something wrong in the past?
Any, they could do it 20 times and you still have that presumption. So the government's just saying we're going to move some from the prescribed list, from the non-prescribed list to the prescribed list. We're asking, what about those on the prescribed list? Are you going to change that neutral presumption to a presumption against so that people who commit those serious crimes do not have a neutral presumption? And the government refuse to answer, which, read between the lines, means they're not changing their weak presumptions.
So my understanding, Katie, is that those that goes to the courts and it's a matter before the courts for them to decide the bail and what conditions are granted around an individual once they've committed an offence.
All right. I gave this example to the police minister earlier in the week and you know, I know my understanding is that it's before the courts now, but there was a, I'm sure most of us have probably seen it, there was terrible vision that started to appear on social media a few weeks back where there was a young man who assaulted two Indigenous men on the ground in Palmerston. That vision then appeared on TikTok. It was really, like, confronting is not the right word. I think the word is more mortifying, to be honest with you. And it did the round then on social media. That young person who committed those offences was then charged and my understanding is released on bail. You know, to me, I don't know what that person's background is. I don't know sort of, you know, whether he's been in trouble before. But to see two older men being belted in the way that they were, for me, was incredibly mortifying. And I just sort of thought to myself, I don't know that that's in line with the community's expectations. You know, that was one of the examples that I'd asked the police minister about earlier in the week. The other thing that drew my attention, obviously, upon viewing that current affairs vision when it aired about a week ago, was the fact that there was a young person who was obviously on bail, as I understand it, who had an electronic monitoring bracelet on in some of that vision which went to air. I asked the police minister whether somebody like that would then be in breach of bail, even though they weren't. It didn't appear as though they were getting involved in that fight that we saw air on a current affair. But to me, it seemed like a really good example of how those monitoring bracelets are not working. If you see somebody on the street, then in that situation, you know, I can only assume out late at night when that was a pretty terrible fight that we saw on the streets of Alice. I guess there's some of the real kind of, to me, there's sort of some of the examples that stick out to me of where the community's expectation maybe isn't being met.
Katie, with the, and it's difficult, I won't talk about those cases because obviously they're potentially matters before the courts. With the electronic monitoring, it monitors someone and it make sure that they uphold the conditions of, it could be bail or it could be a sentence. It could be, you know, an adult could be sentenced to home detention, but they're allowed to go to their workplace, for example. And so that it's another tool for that monitoring and it's another tool to encourage compliance. So
is it
could
monitored
be,
in real time?
I think that the monitoring is something that we've identified because you've got youth, you've got police and you've got adult corrections and that monitoring. Some people have the perception that there's people sitting watching literally where they go.
Well,
I don't know enough detail.
I remember John Elfring was the minister at the time, but going to a media event that they did on this and they said, oh, this is how it's going to work. And they had big computer screens.
Yep.
And they basically said there's a base in Melbourne and if someone breaches their conditions, so the minute someone walks outside of the zone that they're allowed to be in, whatever, some alarm goes off and you'll be notified that this is the problem. So if that happens, surely we should know straight away that someone's
breaching.
Can I unpack this electronic monitoring? So under the Gunner government, if you are a youth who has an electronic monitoring bracelet, you are the people in Melbourne or wherever it is who monitor it, report it to Territory Families. Territory Families then, if they decide to, let the police know. So there's a major breakdown there. We have always said that police should be the ones to have real-time access to electronic monitoring. monitoring. That way, if they want to do bail checks on people, they can do it under their own steam without having to go through other agencies. And, you know, electronic monitoring isn't, you know, the be-all and end-all, but it does drive compliance with bail conditions up by about 40%, which is good because we want to target repeat offending. But the major problem for the Gunner government is the fact that Territory families are the ones who have that information. It really must go to police, and that's something we strongly believe in. But, you know, this what the Gunner government are proposing this week is a lot of, you know, quite frankly, rubbish. It's words to make it sound like it's good. It's a politically expedient solution for them. And, you know, there's been a lot of NGOs come out and damn the Gunner government for what they've proposed. So by the time we get to May, because bear in mind, none of what they propose on Monday is even drafted into law yet. They're just starting from point one. So by the time we get to May, my concern is we're going to have even more watered down garbage than they've already announced.
Well, some of the stuff that was announced, I've got to say, I was quite surprised that it's not already happening.
Exactly.
For example, you know, the fact that the breathalysing, if somebody is behind the wheel, that not being able to happen.
The one that shocked most people, and the Chief Minister even seemed to be surprised about this, was that if you are sent to diversion and you don't complete your diversion, there had been basically no penalty. So you get diversion, you rock up the first day, then you go, nah, stuff this.
Yeah.
And it's like, carry
on. But how
on.
Could the Chief Minister not know that? Well, I knew that. Robin, you would have 100% known that.
Well, and I mean, Robin, I'm interested to hear how people sort of reacted to this in Alice Springs, given the fact that Alice is the place at the moment that many would argue is really struggling.
Well, to be honest, I don't know what the reaction's been like in Alice Springs, but my reaction is what we've heard this week is the government do a U-turn, they've lost control, they've lost direction, they don't know what they're doing, and whilst there's no change on the streets of Alice Springs, then nothing's changed at all, and therefore the last week of Parliament's basically been futile.
Are there also some... I mean, we talk about the presumption of bail and where it should lie, but is it kind of arguing semantics at some level? Because at the end of the day, it's a judge who's going to decide whether the presumptions in favour or against. The judge still makes the decision, and I'm not sure how much they take those requirements into account when they make that decision. Like that case you're talking about, I'm really surprised, and I don't know the details of it. But if the person, I've seen the video. If that person was given bail, I'd be really, really surprised. And I wonder whether there needs to be some kind of accountability within the legal system. You know, in America, if a judge makes a decision, they almost have to front a press conference. You know, like juries go out and talk to the media. It's a much more open system. We have this really closed system here where, you know, judges make decisions, but those decisions are almost beyond any question or any reproach. And I wonder whether we need to bring in some kind of system where, and there may at times, I'm sure there are many, many times where there's good reason why a judge takes into account other considerations when they give someone a sentence that's more lenient than perhaps the public thinks it should be, or give someone bail when perhaps we don't think they should get bail. But I do think there needs to be more open process around that so that we can ask questions about why did you give that person bail, considering that what we saw in that video was so horrific.
And look, I'm happy to be corrected on that one, but my understanding is that a press release came out that did basically, that said they've been charged with X, Y, and Z and bailed.
But that's also because, so that does come back to the presumption. So let's not forget, the courts and the judiciary have to implement the law. Members of Parliament create law. We create law based on community expectation and doing what is right. Yeah. So judges cannot ignore presumptions. If you have a presumption in favour of bail, you will almost certainly get bail. If you have a presumption against bail, you will almost certainly not be bailed. Go and speak to some prosecutors. It is the starting point. So if someone comes to court with a presumption that they should not be bailed, the defence then have to mount an argument that would defeat that presumption. So it puts them in a position of having to fight for that bail. Under the Gunner government, you've got serious offenders who rock up in a neutral position. So it's just like their lawyer argues for bail, the prosecutor argues against. For those non-prescribed offences, so, for example, assault is in the non-prescribed offence list, they have a presumption in favour of bail. So if you're out driving dangerously, causing death or hitting and run or abducting someone, you go to court with a presumption in favour of bail. So the prosecutor has to then mount an argument around why you should not be bailed. I mean, your starting point is very, very important.
Falsy,
that's why we say
that
no
issue?
Bail.
So we want no crime to happen. We want to stop crime before it happens, but we do have people that commit crimes. And so what we announced this week was a range of measures, and some of them were technical things, but we think that they will make a significant difference to keeping our community safe. And in response to, you were talking about the Royal Commission. The Royal Commission was 4 or 5 years ago, and we will continue to implement those recommendations. We know that trauma is a huge factor, people in the child protection system going into the youth justice system and into the adult correction system. So, but we do need to make changes. We do need to be agile in our response, and sometimes it can just be minor things such as electronic monitoring. You know, that has the Surveillance and Devices Act, you know, that comes into play. You know, there can be small things that can make a big difference.
Can I just ask, if they are going to make a significant difference, why are we waiting until August, basically? You know, like, why are we in a situation where it's going through in, it's going to be debated in May, and then realistically those changes won't come into play until much later in the year? Because, you know, look, and I do want to still talk about the Royal Commission and some of the issues that we've got at the moment with young kids on the street. But just to stick with this point for now, you know, if these changes are going to make a significant difference, as you've just said, why aren't we trying to move this a little bit faster so that we can try to stop some of the issues we've got right now?
They don't have it drafted. It's not drafted. It was a press release on Monday. That's it. Parliamentary Council would be scrambling right now to pull something together.
So what I said is, Katie, sometimes a small change can make a big difference. And so we always have to continually look at what laws we have, look at what policies we have, look at what programs we have. And if we need to make changes, we need to do that. And then that can potentially have a big impact. In terms of the legislation, we can't rush this legislation, because if we get the legislation wrong, we can potentially let people off the hook. But we are working on legislation for the May sittings.
How could you be any more off the hook than you are now?
Isn't that happening already? People are getting let off the hook. Look, one of the announcements made too was an extra $5 million into bail accommodation.
Remand centres.
So the government is anticipating a major change here in terms of how many people will not be getting bail.
What I was keen to find out is, where are those remand centres? Where are they currently?
So, Katie, what we've identified is that we've got young people who, in some cases through no fault of their own, don't have a safe place, and that's part of the problem. And so we need to have resources where young people who might not be, you know, that the courts might not feel need to be detained, that diversion is a good option for them, because we want to stop this cycle. But we need a safe place for our community and a safe place for them. So that is that $5 million identified to do work on some locations.
This is where the tricky language comes in. They're calling this remand centres. Now, normally what happens, if you're remanded in custody, you are in prison until your court date. Now, this government created supported bail accommodation. So instead of being bailed to home, you can be bailed, for example, in the Territory to Yira House out in Pinelands. Now, if you are bailed to support a bail accommodation, you can get dropped off, tell everyone hi, thanks a lot for the lift, but stuff you guys, I'm out of here, and walk straight back out. So is this remand centre exactly the same as that? I mean, it's just words. It's meaningless words. These remand centres are another form of supported bail accommodation, which means people can yeah, it's one in the same thing with a brand new name. More money we don't have, and out they go. I mean, the reality is we're building a $50 million youth justice centre at Holt's with only 30 beds. 70 million for 30 beds. What's that per bedroom?
Well, and then, though, we've still got a situation where we've got young kids who are out on the street. You know, and this is something we've spoken about on so many occasions. You know, if you've got 8-year-olds who are unsafe out on the street, not only in Alice Springs, but I'm assuming here in Darwin and Palmerston as well, like, to me, that's an incredibly sad situation.
I think this is what the whole point that gets missed, right? It's like, you know, there's a massive bushfire going on, and we spend all of our time working out sort of how we're going to put it out, and we spend no time thinking about how it starts in the first place. And that's what we need to resolve long term if we're going to fix the issue. I mean, you know, I've got both the major parties who are coming up with their, you know, trying to outdo one another on who can be the sort of toughest at the pointy end. But until we fix the front end, then not a lot's going to change. And that's the one thing I find concerning. I haven't heard many good ideas about what we're going to do about those kids on the street. The only good one I heard was from Robin.
Yeah.
And that that got about, you know, putting beds in the drop-in centre, and that got shut down pretty quickly, I think.
It did. But look, I'm hoping that given the backflip we've seen by government this week, that they'll actually consider implementing youth curfews or trialling youth curfews across the Northern Territory.
But then where are those kids going to go, Robin?
Well, you know, if they can't go home, then there has to be a place for them to go. And, and the interestingly, the bail accommodation centre in Alice Springs, run by Saltbush, has been pretty much empty the whole entire time it's operated.
Because they don't have to be there.
About around 3 years.
Really?
I stand corrected. But yes, it's the most underutilised facility going. And it's fully staffed, it's fully resourced, it's an excellent facility, and there's usually only a couple of kids there.
So, Matt, to use your analogy...
With a capacity of about 30.
To use your analogy about the fire, you still need to put the fire out. No one's disputing that that important work to stop people in a life of crime has to happen, but we do have to put the fire out. And this isn't about, you know, certainly from an opposition's perspective, this isn't some sort of contest with government. Our legislation has been in the pipe being drafted for months and months and months. It takes a long time. And so ours was coming forward this sittings, it always was. The government clearly didn't like that and so tried to obfuscate the issue with a press release on Monday. But the reason we're waiting till May for an introduction of a bill, so don't forget, that's not debate, that's just intro, is because nothing has been done. So we've got press release, we're about 4 days past the press release, 5 days past the press release, and there's nothing on the ground. That's why it can't be done quicker, because government shut us down and don't have their own stuff ready to go.
Natasha, I'm keen to know, because obviously the government's been very much on the line of, you know, you need generational change and that this has to be a generational thing. And now, obviously, there is this further discussion about changing things at the pointy end. Is everyone happy about it?
So, Katie, and it comes to Matt's point there about the bushfire. We know, and I said it just a moment ago, the correlation between child protection and youth justice and young people that have, you know, such trauma in early childhood. And we have seen those child protection statistics, you know, start to plateau and in some cases come down. And so that is good for that longer-term picture. In terms of this work, and I remember speaking to you, Katie, I think it was after the horrific incidents that happened in Queensland, saying if we need to look at things, we will. And so,
yeah, you were the only one though who really was saying
so,
that.
So, you know, these are, and as I, you know, these are small things, but they, that, you know, in legislation, we're always, you know, tidying it up is the word that Parliamentary Council give us, but there's always little technical things that you do need to do, you know, to make sure that you have stronger legislation or it meets the purpose of what it wants to achieve.
I mean, even for you guys though, and as Matt pointed out, we know, you know, the fact that there are youths who are breaking the law and then they're not even completing their diversion, like, to me is quite unbelievable then. If these are programs that we're really hanging our hats upon and trying to give kids, you know, some better options in life, and then we're not even actually checking whether they've completed those diversion programs, to me really points out that we've got a big issue here.
And Katie, we're doing that work, we're acknowledging that, you know, that we have to have, if people are diverted to a program, then we have to know that. And, you know, alcohol policies, you know, within my portfolio, it takes, you know, 10, 12 times for someone to rehabilitate from alcoholism, you know, and that's, you know, they'll attempt, they'll fail, but you've got to keep sticking with it. And so I think that everybody, it needs to be acknowledged, but then the courts need to see how many times or what completion has or what participation has been had in these programs.
But there's completing diversion and then there's completing diversion. Now, it depends what the diversion is. I have sat down with a young woman who's been through the child protection system and whose brothers and sisters have, and the youth justice system. And one bit of diversion their family was the, you know, supposed beneficiary of, was where an NGO came round to their house with a clipboard of questions, ask the youth all the questions. Yep, okay, great. Sign here. That's your diversion. Thank you very much. Off I go. Now, that's technically completing diversion. So the Gunner government feel really good about that. But what on earth has that little questionnaire done to change that young person's life? I would hazard a guess at absolutely bloody nothing.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to De Silva Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was. Leah Finocchiaro, Robin Lamley, Natasha Files and Matt Cunningham in the studio with me. Now, I heard yesterday, because I was a nerd watching and listening to Parliament, former Speaker Kezia Pyrick slammed the government's move yesterday to allow the corruption watchdog access to Blaine MLA Mark Turner's electronic electronic devices as part of an investigation as concerning and an effort and an affront, to democracy. Now, we do know that on Wednesday it was revealed that the Independent Commissioner Against Corruption had launched an investigation into Mr. Turner. As part of that investigation, the ICAC obtained 3 mobile phones and a laptop from the Blaine MLA. Now, I know that the government and the opposition obviously voted to allow this to happen. The ICAC hasn't asked to access privileged information, as I understand it, only that they need permission under law to access these devices at all. Robin, I know that you were with Kezia and also said that, you know, this shouldn't actually be happening.
Well, Katie, it was quite extraordinary what happened in Parliament. I mean, we spent a long time putting together legislation for the ICAC Commissioner. Last month in Parliament, we saw the whole cocaine sex scandal unfold. And this month, we have to make a decision around whether or not to provide certain information to the ICAC Commissioner. And we were given 24 hours to contemplate this decision, and it was quite complex. The clerk of the court, clerk of the parliament, gave, I think, a 16-page analysis of the decision we were expected to make within a very short time frame. So on that ground, I thought it was extraordinary. It was a little bit outrageous. And I thought I took the advice of the clerk and I decided to vote against it. And Kezia had her own issues around that. But I just felt that it was compromising the integrity of the parliament and it shouldn't have been rushed in the first place. And I'm not sure that it was a good decision.
Yeah, I guess from an outside looking in kind of perspective, I thought to myself, if the opposition and the government don't actually vote with this, particularly the government, it would have looked as though there was something to hide.
Yeah, well, I certainly was thought it was very curious. I think the government obviously lost a lot of skin over the Labor cocaine sex scandal. And, of course, things are very, very cosy with the member for Blaine and the Labor government. And we actually tried to ask the Speaker a question in Parliament this week around what is the status of the member for Blaine?
Was he in Parliament?
He was for parts of it, yeah. We thought then it was very curious that the government, in what I called a sort of an attempt to look tough on this issue for the first time ever, in effectively bringing this motion to hang the member for Blaine out to dry. Now, of course, we agree that the ICAC should be investigating the member for Blaine for his conduct, and whatever comes of that is, you know, entirely a matter for the ICAC. The government have been on the back foot on this issue for a long time. The member for Blaine still sits on their side of the chamber. Things are awfully close over there. He actually voted to support knocking down our bail legislation, so he votes with government. So I don't know, Natasha, what is the status of the member for Blaine? He's just on in the sin bin for a while and then he'll be back?
Come on, Tash, tell us.
You need his number.
So I do need to be careful with my comments, Katie, because the ICAC is clearly investigating a matter, and so it would be inappropriate to make any comments.
But that's not to do with whether he sits on Labor's side or not, though, is it? That's your decision, not the ICAC's.
The member for Blaine, you know, we went over this a few weeks ago. He did not treat the Labor caucus with respect, and so the caucus team has said he's not welcome in our party room, in our team. He still is a Labor member of Parliament, but he doesn't come into our caucus room or work
really
with us.
I've really grappled with this because I keep thinking, he's not good enough then to be part of the Labor caucus, but he's good enough, you know, for the people of Blaine. And that's, I think, what I've struggled with.
I don't think he is good enough for the people of Blaine, but Labor thinks so.
Matt, what did you make of it all, mate?
Well, I've got some broader problems just with how the ICAC works and how it's all been set up. Because I think, you know, we're always told that sort of we can't, you know, make public, oh, the ICAC's investigating this or the ICAC's investigating that. And yet, and members of the public, like if someone makes a complaint to the ICAC, my understanding is, and then the ICAC comes back and says, yes, we've received this and we're going to look into it. My understanding is that person can't go public and say, you know, yada, yada.
All right.
But the Chief Minister can go public and say, I'm referring this to the ICAC and it becomes front page news. I think that's a real problem.
So did he refer it to the ICAC or did the ICAC say that they,
the Chief Minister.
It's the ICAC, and he gave the exclusive story to the NT News, and they ran it on the front page.
Yeah, that's a very good
point. I think that's a problem. And I also think it's a problem, you know, I know the ICAC commissioner comes in here from time to time and does interviews. I think that's a big problem. You know, he makes these public statements where he sort of foreshadows these big damning reports that are going to be coming out. You know, I don't have a problem with that, Matt.
I like him coming on and telling us what's happening.
Of course you do. It makes for great radio. But I think he should be basically seen and not heard publicly, which is what happens in other jurisdictions.
I
would prefer he had open hearings into the investigations that he's having, and yet the hearings are closed. And I'd prefer he said nothing publicly about what he's investigating, or, you know, whether he's looking into this, or whether he might, you know, even if he's vague about the details. I think he should say nothing publicly. I think it's a real problem.
It's also concerning that the correspondence, instead of coming to the Assembly, comes to the Chief Minister.
That's the thing that I was a little bit worried about, is if down the track there is a situation, and I'm purely talking hypothetically here, if there is a situation where the government is investigated over something, does the Chief Minister still receive that correspondence first before it's presented to Parliament, or does it... What exactly is the process?
It should go to the Assembly.
Yeah.
It should go to the Assembly. It should go probably to the Speaker as the leader of the Assembly,
I'm honestly just not 100% sure, and I guess that's something that I would be able to ask, you know, the Commissioner.
Well, and the other issue I have, and I think... Tash almost made the point indirectly before, when the first thing she said was, oh, I've got to be careful about what I say because it's under investigation by the ICAC. Mission accomplished by the government. Refer it to the ICAC.
And then you
it's
can't
an
talk
ICAC
about
investigation
it.
And now we can't talk about it.
I think that's just a convenient excuse more than anything else. I mean, we get that all the time. It's like, oh, this is under investigation, or this is a matter before the courts, and then it just shuts down all debate, when the reality is you can still talk about things. It's just how you talk about
it. Yeah, true, that's the way it gets used. And you know, in the case of Mark Turner, I mean, you know, do we have a huge amount of evidence that he's done something corrupt? I don't know. But there's also the problem when you come out and say, I'm referring someone to the ICAC, or the ICAC, it's confirmed that the ICAC's investigating something, whether there's any evidence or not, that person is tarred with the brush of corruption. You're being investigated by the Corruption Commission. And so I think we really need to have a good think about how we deal with these matters, because at the moment I reckon it's all over the shop.
And what we saw play out in Parliament was highly irregular, because we don't know what the referral was to ICAC. So a big piece of the puzzle was missing. I just felt that it was highly suspicious. And I think there's a rat there. This is what I said in Parliament. I can't put my finger on what the rat is, but I think over time it will become clearer.
360's The Week That Was. Thanks to the Silver Hebron, your local lawyers.
You are listening to The Week That Was. In the studio with us this morning, Matt Cunningham, Natasha Files, Robin Lamley and Leah Finocchiaro. Now, Matt Cunningham, you ran, well, a couple of interesting pieces this week, but one that I'll go to first is these increases in grog-related hospital presentations in the top end that have cast doubt on the effectiveness of the Northern Territory government's alcohol floor price. The latest data, you've obtained, shows that alcohol-related emergency department presentations at Royal Darwin and Palmerston Regional Hospitals have risen in each of the two full years since the floor price was introduced. Now, I guess it sort of goes against some of that other data that had been spouted by some of the universities, or one of the universities I think I caught up with not too long ago. Robin, I believe that you've certainly been out having a chat to Matt and said there's a big problem with the government's alcohol policy right throughout the Northern Territory.
Yeah, look, the stats came out recently and showed a 10% across the board increase in alcohol-related presentations at emergency departments in Territory hospitals. And that's alarming in itself, but a little town like Tennant Creek, the Tennant Creek Hospital had around a 27% increase in alcohol-related presentations.
And alcohol-related assaults in Tennant Creek are up 68% and 31% across the Territory. It's a big issue.
I think it's fascinating that the Health Minister hasn't told us this publicly, because I know you do like to tell us good news.
Only good news.
isn't good news, and we haven't heard this directly from you.
Tell us about
so, please, Minister, would you like to explain? Here's the microphone now.
Let me just bring one more bit of information in before we give her a chance to respond, because I went searching for this data because, you know, well, I think it was a review, something that came out of the Riley review, was that the data that needed to be published in a timely fashion. And I went looking for this emergency presentation data.
And was it published in a timely fashion?
Well, the figures have been only updated until March 2020, and we're in March 2021. Mm. Although, to the government's credit, when I did ask them, they did promptly update the figures.
Yeah. But so they had them, they just weren't putting them
they
up.
They did take a bit of prompting.
A bit like the BDR. Well, remember, they weren't going up either. It's a pile-on posse.
I've
got a microphone now. For listeners, I didn't even have a mic a minute ago.
We like it that way.
Katie.
I don't.
Leah, say what you really think.
She doesn't have a mic.
People are like, Natasha's quiet. It's like she's been gagged.
Just for our listeners.
Well, she gags us all week. Now it's her payback.
Just for our listeners, Robin Lavely and Natasha Files are sharing a microphone at the moment. So despite what some may think, we all get along quite well in here. They are sharing that microphone.
They've handed the ball over to me.
We've handballed it to you. What's your response?
So, Katie, we know that alcohol-related harm is a huge issue. We know that not one policy will solve those issues. The floor price, and I was surprised, Matt, to read your article the day before last. I was like, I don't remember. But it came off the conversation we had on this show a week or two ago about,
I spoke to you about this outside the hospital on the day that people got their jabs in their arm.
Delirious
with excitement about the photoshoots of the Chief Minister getting a jab in his arm. Make you dizzy with happiness.
But, Katie, in all seriousness, you know, we need to be agile with alcohol policy, and with the payments that we've seen from the Commonwealth this past year, the COVID payments, it is difficult because you don't want to deny someone the ability to have access to more money to buy, you know, fresh food. But we certainly have seen anecdotally an increase.
There's obvious, you know, like that is something that's certainly come into play. Matt and I, we've spoken about this on a couple of occasions on air. You know, it's obvious that that's had an impact. But, you know, then we sort of have a situation where, you know, when you've got things like the basics card, people sort of crying out saying they don't want that. I just don't know how we kind of juggle this if we have got a situation where some of that money then is just being boozed up.
It is really difficult, the fact that you want to give money to people, because we know that if we can provide those supports, then we have a safer community. But at the same time, when it's being misspent, that's not where taxpayer dollars should be going.
I have a problem with this, because all our alcohol strategies aren't based on how much money people have access
to.
Yeah, the floor
prices.
Not the volume of money. I mean, you know, police outside of bottle shops, it shouldn't matter if that people are coming through the bottle shop with $1,000 or $10. You know, it's about assessing people as they come through. Mm. The alcohol floor price is a furphy. I don't think it's ever worked. Interestingly, about 18 months ago, the Medical Journal of Australia printed, which I consider probably one of the most weakest pieces of research I've ever come across, saying that the floor price in Alice Springs was a resounding success. And it just isn't so. And the piece of research was absolutely flawed. I think the floor prices had absolutely nil effect on changing people's behaviour. I think that there are problems, big problems, in the government's alcohol strategy. I think they've failed to tweak things adequately over the last couple of years. They put in measures, they took away measures, they put in measures, and they've been idle for too long. Mm. A lot of work.
My biggest issue is that I think that both the government and the advocates for these policies rush to see success, yet they're quick to hide failure. Talk about the you were talking about the researchers and the people you're speaking to. They're from Deakin University. Now, last month they published an article on the Conversation website that said the floor price in the Northern Territory had been a resounding success and that it should be rolled out nationally as a result. Goodness. Well, they certainly asked that question. Now, they based that on a serious reduction in sales of cask wine, and they said there'd been little substitution. Now, I reckon that they rushed to that conclusion, I would argue, because even speaking to the police commissioner, he's been pretty clear that, that the police have seen a huge transference, and it's been made worse by the COVID money situation,
yep.
from people drinking cask wine to people drinking spirits,
hard
in
liquor.
Particular
liquor, yeah.
Bundaberg rum. You know, you see the evidence of it, you know,
around
the city, and I think that has had other problems, you know,
yeah,
because of that substitution. And, you know, as we know, as I know, when you drink Bundy rum, you get a really ordinary kind of drunk.
And that's the thing. Rats. You know, you're not going to spend $30 on a 2-litre cask. You'll spend $35 on a bottle of rum. The floor price is one measure. That's right, but you're not measuring any of them.
Know,
we said right from the start, if you're going to implement all these measures, you've got to be able to assess them as you go and change them as you go, and you haven't. And looking at Tennant Creek, I mean, 68% increase in alcohol-related harm in Tennant Creek. Tennant Creek has some of the harshest, most restrictive alcohol policies, I don't know, probably in the world, quite frankly. And this government promised them over 2 years ago to review the measures that were put in place. They just left the people of the Barkly in the dark, and now they've come back and put in place even more measures. I think, you know, an important part is that this prohibition approach of this government isn't working.
Yeah, but then what's on the other hand? Like, do you just sort of give up? And this is where I find it quite tough. And, you know, while there's elements of the government's alcohol policy that I don't necessarily agree with, there's other parts that I think to myself, goodness me, one of the biggest issues we've got in the Northern Territory is our misuse of alcohol. You know, even throughout the week, Matt, another article that you'd published was, you know, the fact that Jacinta Price had taken two young Indigenous women to Canberra on their fight when it comes to domestic violence and the issues that they've got in their communities with the misuse of alcohol. You know, do we just stop trying? And we can't.
Of course,
you
know, not. What's interesting is, but we need to measure the success.
Robin,
I mean, we've driven secondary supply is now out of control across the territory. So we're forcing people to undertake riskier behaviours to get to the grog, which is why you have to deal with people's addiction in the first place. And that living with alcohol concept, you know, like you, if you just take it away and flat out ban people, they will get in another way. And then we're seeing people driving long distances to get it. We're seeing secondary supply. People are grog running and doing all this other stuff. It takes police resources then to be out and stopping people on borders and back roads and all of this kind of stuff. It's just creating a bigger problem for police and for the community than what we started with. So it's got to be reviewed and addressed. Even the banned drinker register, you know, we've always said it needs to be reviewed and enhanced. Like, that must have better and more capability. But this government sets and forgets and then leaves it.
But, Katie, it's interesting to pick up Robin's point that she doesn't support the floor price. Alice Springs has had, through voluntary liquor accords, price and product restrictions for many years. It was the Northern Territory in the mid-90s under a CLP government that, you know, tried to first, and it was ruled as a taxation, which isn't under their domain, but tried to address these issues. So we have to be agile. The floor price is one measure aimed at getting rid of that really cheap wine that people use to get intoxicated. And there's a raft of other measures, and we need to continue to work on them.
Well, it's just money in the pockets of bottle shops. That's what the floor price is, a tax on Territorians and responsible drinkers.
But we've got a risk-based licensing model that reflects the license fees, you know, now reflect the volume and the amount of sale, but also the behaviour of those licensees.
I do think the government deserves credit for the fact that they have tried to tackle this issue and in a really serious way. My only issue would be that we need to be honest about the way that we assess these things.
Because
if we're not, we're not going to know what works and what doesn't.
Make
and we
sure
end
the,
up with paying millions
the,
of dollars
make
for
sure
drug
evidence
policies
is used.
That don't
the
work.
Other thing I would say, though, is obviously make sure that evidence is used to support which programs work. But the other concern that I've got is that we make sure that there are adequate measures in place for people who have serious substance issues, i.e. alcoholism, so that they're able to actually get the support they need.
And, Katie, I'll take those points on board. And we did a recent, the rehabilitation beds, the treatment beds, we did a demand study and it did find that we had adequate beds. But I'll take those points on board because I think that this is something that Territorians want to see addressed and they get it's a long road.
Yeah.
But we do need to, you know, we did have the Riley Review. We had our reports back on that. We do need to keep the community updated because it's not front of centre, but those policies are still working and we have seen, you know, some figures that are concerning and I've been speaking with my agencies around that. You know, what is it that we need to do? What is the impact of those COVID payments? But absolutely committed to addressing these issues.
We are going to have to take a very short break.
360's The Week That Was.
thanks to the Silver Hebron, your local lawyers.
Well, we did have so much else planned to talk about this morning, but time always gets away from us. Before we wrap up, though, I am keen to very briefly talk about the situation that tourism is in. We know that it's a difficult time for tourism, but Tourism Top End General Manager Glenn Hindley has told the NT News that he fears that the top end tourism industry is about to lose millions in economic dollars to WA because of the government's ban on Australian-based expedition cruise boats. This is a really tough one because, I mean, cruises, that was sort of the epicentre of where things began with COVID. So I can understand why we're taking a very cautious route here, but we obviously don't want to be losing tourism dollars.
We've been working with industry. So these are the smaller expedition cruise ships, Katie. They're traditionally 200 people or less on board. The Chief Health Officer has been getting the advice out of AHPPC, and we've had numerous meetings with the companies that run these vessels. I understand the Chief Health Officer will be issuing a direction saying that those cruises can go ahead if there's 100 people or less on board those vessels, because there's a number of factors that have to be taken into account. If we were to see an outbreak, how would we manage that, etc.? So that's the advice that we've received. It is really difficult. These cruise ships, you know, on paper, it seems like a great way to reinvigorate, tourism in the territory, but we also need to be really cautious that we're only a case away from potentially a community outbreak.
I think what's important for listeners to really understand, though, is these cruise ships we're talking about are Australians from Australia with Australian crew and staff only travelling within Australia and not travelling from any hotspots. So it's really no different to an aeroplane, except obviously taking into account that there's greater transmission opportunity on a ship. But with all the right safeguards, there's got to be a way to make this happen. And I just find the contradiction stark when international vessels can dock at Cullen Bay and then go through a COVID screening process and then have to walk up the pontoon and into a bus. So we're allowing that, but we're not allowing Australians in at the wharf. It just feels like there's a contraction there, and all things aren't being equal.
I think you're mixing apples with pears there, Leah. So there's processes in place, Katie, for international vessels coming into Australia. The numbers have greatly reduced, but a vessel, they can dock in the territory, and there's strict processes to get their passengers and crew off, and they go and undertake their quarantine. So what this is cruises, these small boats, but we're saying we think 100 people is safe, and we'll always put the safety of Territorians first.
Well, we are going to have to wrap up for the morning. It's always great to have you all in the studio with us. Leah Finocchiaro, Opposition Leader, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Have a lovely weekend, everyone. I hope it keeps raining in the Top End and in Alice. I hope you're getting some nice cooler weather soon.
Hopefully. Yeah. And of course, Robin Lamley, the independent member for
Araluen. Thank you so much for having me, Katie.
It's always great to have you in the studio when you're here, Rob. And Natasha Files, the Health Minister and also the member for Nightcliffe. Thanks for jumping back in the studio. We know Kate Warden was going to come in, but I understand she's not... she's a bit crook at the moment, so great to have you in the studio with us.
And Katie, the real reason I came was not just the company of you wonderful people, but to talk about last Saturday night, the mighty Nightcliffe Tigers.
Yeah, I know, it was a cracker.
I'm sure Matt will elaborate, but it was an amazing game. But well done to everyone involved in the NTFL finals, the women's final. Great to have
Absolutely. The
Saints players. You need an opposition, but those Tigers, it was spectacular.
Yeah,
I've watched a lot of games of football in my life, Katie. You probably understand.
Yeah.
I've never seen a game
that
like
good.
It.
Really?
In a grand final for a team to be down by 18 points with 4 minutes to go, and it was just incredible. There were almost 10,000
awesome.
People at the ground. It was just something else.
Oh, so
it
good.
It was spectacular.
I love the footy, no matter what code you're talking about. Good on you all. Thanks so much for your time this morning as well. Matt Cunningham from Sky News. And that is it for the week that was.